Carolinas are being swamped by these heavy rains and high winds from Hurricane Florence.
The best scientists in the world are all telling us that our activities are changing the climate.
I don't think it's a hoax. I think there's probably a difference, but I don't know that it's man-made.
Experts say that we have until 2030 to avoid catastrophe.
Hi, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point. The United Nations has called a special session on climate change. Greta Thunberg, the 16-year-old Swedish girl who's become a worldwide celebrity for activism on this issue, took a sailboat across the Atlantic Ocean in order to be able to attend the session without adding to her climate footprint. Then she addressed a joint committee of Congress.
My name is Greta Thunberg. I have not come to offer any prepared remarks at this hearing. I'm instead attaching my testimony. It is the IPCC Special Report on Global Warming of 1.5 degrees Celsius, the SR1.5, which was released on October 8, 2018. I am submitting this report as my testimony because I don't want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to the scientists, and I want you to unite behind the science. And then I want you to take real action. Thank you.
The need for meaningful action is already the theme of events in the U.S. and around the world. There's a global school strike by students and a work stoppage by the employees of some major companies. Polita Clark is a business columnist for the Financial Times, speaking to us from London. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Pleasure to be here, Warren.
You reached out to a number of companies to check on where they were with regard to what's being called a climate strike. Tell us, if you will, a little bit more about what the climate strike is, and then we'll hear about your research.
Yes. So after Greta Thunberg began striking herself and encouraged other students around the world to follow suit, which they did in very large numbers, it was decided that it would be an idea if adults joined the student strikers. And about 3 or 4 months ago, I heard that this was going to be happening around the time of the UN Climate Summit. And it struck me as a quite an interesting movement. I was the FT's environment correspondent from 2011 to the beginning of last year. And if anybody had told me during that time that workers were going to seriously consider going out on strike over climate change, I would have been extremely surprised. But as it turns out, a number are. And I decided to try to find out in about June, July, how exactly what numbers might actually be doing this. So, and also what response companies might take to this sort of action. So I emailed about a dozen companies to see what they thought of the planned action and how they might treat any employees who were going to take part. You know, were they going to dock the pay of a striking worker? And what was their policy on workers joining public protests? And the companies came back with some quite interesting results. This was obviously by no means a scientific study, but at one end of the spectrum, there was the outdoor clothing company Patagonia, which of course has a long history of environmental activism and itself, and was founded by an environmentalist and is privately held. It told me at the time that it actively encourages employees to take part in these sorts of protests, and it had even a policy of providing bail for workers who were arrested if they took part in this sort of action. But it turns out that this week they've decided they're actually going to be closing their stores worldwide so that their workers can take part in this strike. I've not heard of any other company of its size that's going to be doing that. However, there are also some interesting moves that seem to be coming from the tech companies. Amazon is leading the charge there, but we're also seeing signs that Facebook, Google, Microsoft employees are also going to be joining the climate strike. So I think that, you know, that is quite an interesting shift that we haven't really seen before. At the other end of the spectrum, though, I would say that most of the companies that I contacted, even ones run by eco-billionaires, Michael Bloomberg's Bloomberg Group, Sir Richard Branson's Virgin Group, they were were much more hesitant about saying what they might be doing. In fact, Bloomberg declined to comment to me at all at the time. IKEA, another very big investor in renewables, told me that it didn't have a global policy on workers joining the protest. It was exploring it to see what its approach was going to be. Some, the energy companies that I contacted included Shell, BP, Exxon. Shell did get back to me, unlike the others that I contacted, and said that it basically supported peaceful protests and its employees could seek leave to join these sorts of actions. But I think it's going to be quite interesting to see what actually happens on the day.
Let me ask you a little bit more about Patagonia. You didn't talk to or didn't reach out to little tiny companies. You reached out to companies that might be making major contributions to global warming, given what they do. How much of a hit to the business will it be for Patagonia if they have to close all their stores worldwide for a whole day?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. I mean, they're privately held, which means that they don't have to answer to shareholders in the way that a publicly listed company does. But one assumes that it's going to affect their revenues on that day. It's not the first time, of course, that they've done this. So I'm assuming that it's something that they feel that they can easily weather. They also closed their stores last year during the midterm elections in the US so that people could go and vote. They were very much in favour of getting voter turnout to reasonable levels. So for them, I think they've it's not something that's going to be substantially, I doubt very much it's going to substantially impact their financial performance, but it's clearly something that you couldn't say it was going to be negligible either.
Well, given their marketing strategy and their emphasis on climate and on the environment, maybe it's good for business.
Well, exactly. That's right. And, you know, you see a lot of the companies that are supporting this strike adhere to that strategy as well. I mean, some of the other companies that are reportedly going to be backing it include Ben & Jerry's, the ice cream makers. Also in Germany, there's an ethical bank called GLS, which is actually one of the first groups that I came across that said that it was going to close on September 20th.
So that all its employees. Bank? Is that a contradiction in terms?
they specifically exist to finance environmental projects and social ventures. And, they've been quite vocal over here. So, I mean, again, though, you know, I think this is an interesting point, really, that for some companies, backing this sort of action, it makes a lot of business sense. And indeed, it's interesting when you think about it in the context of the Business Roundtable, you know, a group of more than 180 chief executives of some of the largest companies in the US, which very revealingly and eye-catchingly last month announced that it was no longer really going to, the CEOs were no longer going to commit to leading their companies solely for the benefit of shareholders, but they also wanted them to be led to the benefit of all stakeholders. That included customers and employees. It also, in its statement, talked about maintaining a healthy environment. You know, we're starting to see at the moment what some people think is quite an inflection point in the way that companies are thinking about these issues and their role, their broader role. There are many different ways of looking at this, and one way of looking at it is that, you know, this is really a lot of quite sophisticated marketing, that these companies recognize that they are existing in an environment in which climate change is rapidly rising up the political agenda in many countries, not all, but in many. And there's certently a widening shift in awareness and activism, which is being demonstrated by not just the student strikes and Greta Thunberg's influence, but also over here in particular in the UK, Extinction Rebellion, much more radical climate civil disobedience movement, which has managed to close the streets of London for days on end, and really seems to have prompted some interesting responses from government. The UK very recently became the first G7 country to put in to legislation and net zero emissions goal for 2050. Others have followed since then, and indeed there's been a rash of climate emergencies announced by hundreds of local government bodies and cities and so forth. So I think, you know, we do seem to be seeing much more awareness and activism, and businesses that fail to recognise this, I think, risk being seen to be somewhat behind the ball, and I think there's a growing awareness of that within companies.
You mentioned the Business Roundtable and their announcement that they would no longer emphasize shareholders only. That goes against many years of practice and theory articulated first by Milton Friedman, that the only thing a CEO should be worried about is the shareholders and nobody else's matters at all. Has there been any outcry from shareholders about involvement in the kind of activities that we're seeing this week?
From shareholders, I actually haven't seen... You mean the climate strikes?
Or yeah. Are they saying, wait a minute, that is not necessarily in our interests? Or are they not often organized in any way, but they do sometimes show up at annual meetings.
Right, yes. No, I haven't actually seen any shareholder backlash to date. I suspect they may be waiting to see who actually turns out and what might happen. I mean, Weston will no doubt talk about this more, but Amazon does seem to be very much in the forefront of this when it comes to the tech companies. I believe that it's close, 900 or more than 1,000 people are saying that they're going to be walking out, whereas the numbers seem to be much lower at Facebook and Google, and possibly Microsoft as well. So I think, you know, shareholders may well think that this is not something that they need to worry about too much at this point.
Again, Polita Clark is a business columnist for the Financial Times in London. Weston Fribley is with us. He is an employee of one of the companies we've been talking about, and that is Amazon. He is a member of the Amazon Employees for Climate Justice. Weston Fribley, good to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
So tell us what's going on in Seattle.
Yeah, so on September 20th, I, along with now just over 1,500 of my Amazon coworkers, will be joining together to call on Amazon to establish a company-wide goal of zero emissions by 2030, along with the end to custom AWS, that's Amazon Web Services, contracts with fossil fuel companies, and an end to funding for climate-denying lobbying groups and politicians that Amazon has funded. So we'll be joining together ourselves as Amazon employees, and then we'll be later joining the youth-led student march that's happening in Seattle. I think it's really important for tech workers to show up for the students and let them know that we're ready for the challenge of making a company like Amazon carbon-free.
To what extent are the demands you're making contrary to the business structure, the marketing plan, if you will, of Amazon? And how do you deliver all those packages so fast if you don't use fossil fuels?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as an Amazon employee, one of the first things that we learn is that you can't really get anywhere unless you set big, ambitious, and often audacious goals. And so something like zero emissions by 2030, I mean, obviously we know that that's an incredibly ambitious goal to take. But I do think it's absolutely doable. You know, Amazon is a massive company that has incredible resources and employs, you know, thousands upon thousands of very, very smart people. So there are things that we can do immediately, you know, expanding electric vehicle programs, making more investments in renewable energy for our cloud computing business. There's those things that can be done just immediately right out the gate. But, you know, if Amazon, you know, if the history of this company has shown us anything, it's that, you know, Amazon is capable of totally remaking entire industries when it sets its mind to it. And that's something that we really absolutely need. It's why Amazon is so critical. Its position as a, as a trendsetter in the logistics industry is a huge, that's a huge opportunity to both for Amazon to remove the risk that it has by relying so heavily on fossil fuels, but also just to show that that industry is, that it's possible to achieve the kinds of logistics, shipping, the speed that Amazon is known for. I think Amazon has this opportunity to show that it's possible to do that with zero carbon.
Capable of renewing entire industries. That's an extraordinary story. And of course, it's absolutely true in connection with Amazon. You say there are a lot of smart people there, including the guy at the top, Jeff Bezos. What has he had to say about it?
Yeah, so I was one of there were a good number of us Amazon employees who attended the annual shareholder meeting this year. We had filed a shareholder resolution calling on the company to produce a company-wide plan and goals around carbon reduction. And at that meeting, Jeff Bezos was there, and he said, he said it's hard to find an issue more important than climate change. That's obviously encouraging to hear. It's hard to find an issue more important than climate change. That rhetoric has to be coupled with actual action that prioritizes carbon reduction across the company. In response to the shareholder resolution, we gathered, there were over 8,000 Amazon employees who publicly put their names on an open letter in support of that resolution. And in response, the company did announce a program they're calling Shipment Zero, which is a commitment to reducing 50% of shipments to net zero emissions by 2030. And that was obviously an incredibly encouraging thing to see. It's a limited program that covers just 50% of shipments. It doesn't cover, for example, the cloud computing business or our supply chain, the production of Kindle devices and Alexa devices, which produce carbon emissions. So it's really encouraging. And I think a lot of us here, a lot of the employees, a lot of the people that I've spoken to, who I work with, who are, very concerned about our company's contribution to climate change, we're very much encouraged that our work in putting a spotlight on this issue has resulted in something like Shipment Zero. But it's really critical that we show up, for example, on the 20th to talk about why we need a complete company-wide policy of carbon reduction.
Interesting. Shareholder meetings obviously are often somewhat selective in their makeup, but did you get the impression that the shareholders of Amazon, at least those who turned up, are not just sympathetic, but that they might be willing to see a reduction in the value of their shares if, in fact, that's what it takes to deal with what is the most important issue that the world has to offer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was an incredible moment. So at the shareholder resolution, each group that's bringing forth a resolution has a chance to stand up and give a short speech about, why the resolution should be adopted. And, most of these are pretty dry and, don't get a lot of reaction from the people who are there. But ours is a little bit different. There was, one of the members of our group stood up, and at the beginning of her speech, she asked for anyone in the audience who supported the resolution to stand up. Of course, all of us Amazon employees who came, we all stood up. But also, most people at the meeting stood up. These people who are showing up in their very nice, suits and these sort of investor types, the kind of people who would attend a shareholder meeting. They were all standing up with us. And that was incredibly, just incredibly exciting to see. The other thing about the resolution, large investment companies are often advised by firms that specialize in analyzing these shareholder resolutions. And in the U.S., there are two large firms that do this, and both of them recommended that their clients vote for this resolution. And I think that really speaks to the fact that, you know, investors are increasingly aware that exposure to fossil fuels is a real strategic risk for companies. You know, there's going to be a market correction that starts to price in the true cost of burning fossil fuel. And, you know, any company that's overly reliant and doesn't have a plan to decarbonize is really going to be at a disadvantage.
So you're talking not just about some version of political correctness, but rather the bottom line.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, certainly, you know, the importance of this issue for me comes from a deep desire to see the planet not suffer these incredible consequences, mass extinctions, and humanitarian disaster, and that it's an incredibly morally compelling issue that's just so easy. It's so easy to see coming, and we can still avoid it. So for me, you know, I think about, you know, I used to live in the Southern California and you know, hearing about towns whose wells had gone dry, or, you know, I grew up in the Midwest and there's been record flooding and you know, just every day it's hard to avoid the fact that this is getting worse. And so that's the most important thing for me. But I think also important, you know, the reason why we took the approach of filing a shareholder resolution is that, you know, it is something that, you know, it can be seen by these companies as a true opportunity. The kind of innovation that a company like Amazon could achieve if it really set its mind and prioritized carbon reduction. It's a huge opportunity for almost any company.
We want to talk about what's at stake for those who are planning to participate, what they're hoping for. And we're going to talk to a young woman very much involved in the student protest in just a moment on To the Point. And don't forget, this is KCRW's UnDrive. We're asking you to contribute, but we're not interrupting our regular programming in order to do it. This is your chance. Do it now. Warren Olney back with To the Point, talking today about preparations for the student strike in support of the UN session on climate change. Elsa Mengistu is an activist and organizer for climate justice, and she's coordinator for Zero Hour. She's organizing a strike on the Howard University campus in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us once again.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
What are you looking forward to 2 days from now?
I'm looking forward to thousands, maybe millions of kids across the country and across the world demanding climate action, and specifically youth in the United States marching and advocating for the era of the Green New Deal. That is what I'm excited for. I'm excited for all this new energy that is popping out of everywhere, and I'm excited for this new era we're about to jump into.
Before you came on, we heard from Greta, the young woman from Sweden, telling the Congress today that what she wants to see is action. You're in Washington, D.C. You take a look at that and pay attention to what's going on in Congress. What do you, as a student there, think is happening? Are they paying attention? Have they read the report of the IPCC, as she suggested, that came out 2 years ago?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think some of them have. I think some of them have not. Regardless of the fact, there are a lot of people that have read it and are ignoring what it says, and there are a lot of people not reading it and making a fool of themselves. A lot of my colleagues are in Congress testifying right beside Greta today from Zero Hour, and so I feel their anger and their frustration at elected officials talking down to them about what they know is going to save their lives. And so I don't think a lot of these congressional members know what they're saying, or I don't know. It's just really frustrating.
How important is Greta herself, and how do you think she has come to be as important as she is?
I think Greta is very important in the sense that she's able to shift our climate conversation into an international one that literally has led to students skipping school in mass droves. She is a reflection of what this movement looks like, at least part of what this movement looks like. And she's influential. She did change the course of our climate conversation.
Why do you think she was able to do that? Tell me a little bit more about your sense of her influence.
Yeah. Actually, Greta was inspired by the work that we were doing at Zero Hour, and that led her to school strike in Sweden. But I think what was really interesting about Greta is that she did not join a regular organization. She did not organize a march. She did things on her own. She started striking from school, and that's not something that happens very regularly. And I think this, her doing that alone started to inspire lots of people. We've seen marches. We've seen marches. We organize marches all the time. Those are nothing new. But skipping school, stopping the flow of money when you have adults skipping work, I think that is something that really we haven't seen on a mass scale before. And I think that really shifted the paradigm. And like, that's what she did.
To what extent are you at Climate Justice and Coordinator for Zero Hour affiliated with other student groups around the country?
At Zero Hour, we work with lots of different organizations. We're part of the Youth Striking Coalition, which houses all of the youth climate organizations that are striking and organizing the strikes across the country. Personally, I work with a number of organizations off campus, throughout DC. I'm currently working with Future Coalition as well. They are the coalition in which all the climate strikes are also coexisting. Well, they're facilitating the coalition where all the coalition strike planning is happening. And so, like, the climate movement, the youth climate movement, is very interconnected. There's not an organization that we don't work with. That's just how it kind of works with us.
You don't do this for free. Where do you get the money?
Oh, that's a good question. We struggle with that a lot. We are grassroots. And so that is actually a question we're still trying to figure out.
Elsa Mengistu, once again, with the Climate Justice and Coordinator for Zero Hour at Howard University. Can you stay with us for a couple of more minutes?
I can do a few.
Okay. A busy person. Let me go to our other guests. Weston Fribley of the Amazon Employees for Climate Justice. I'm interested in anything you'd like to ask Elsa.
I mean, I don't know if I have anything to ask. I'm just incredibly inspired by the work that students have been doing. And kind of like I mentioned before, I think it's really important for those of us who are working, you know, at companies like Amazon, to make it clear that, you know, we're ready. We're hearing this call and we want to join, and that, you know, we're ready in our work to take on the challenge of, you know, decarbonizing these companies.
So, Elsa, presumably that's what you want to hear. Is there anything you want to ask Weston Fribley?
I don't have any questions, but thank you for striking with us. I think it's vital that adults are striking with youth. Like, an intergenerational movement is everything that we need, and I'm so excited to have the support of, like, workers from all across the country.
Okay, you're busy. You're trying to organize and get something going for 2 days from now. And thanks a lot for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Okay, you too. Elsa, good luck on Friday. Elsa Mengistu with Climate Justice and Zero Hour. Polita Clark, let me go back to you. Once again, our business columnist for the Financial Times, listening to us in London. I'm interested in your take on what we've heard from both Weston Fribley and Elsa Mengistu.
Well, just one point that Elsa made that I think is very interesting. She pointed out that Greta Thunberg basically acted on her own. She didn't join an NGO or an established climate movement or climate campaign group. She went out there by herself. She is an extraordinary individual, obviously. Anybody who's seen her will know that. But I think she also represents a broader shift that we're seeing where people are deciding for themselves to take action that they may not have taken before, because I think as I was saying earlier, the awareness about the urgency of the urgent need to act on climate change is something that has really changed in the last 18 months or so. In fact, I think we may look back at 2018 as being very much a turning point, because up until then, we'd been going for several years. For several years, we'd seen emissions, global emissions, start to flatten out. And really, at the beginning of 2018, it was realised that in 2017, they'd started growing again. And indeed, in 2018, they reached record levels. And so that was the precursor to the IPCC report coming out in the fall, showing just what needed to be done to limit emissions. And I think that there was, in a way, almost a democratic deficit, where very large numbers of people, particularly younger people, had been telling pollsters and surveyors and anyone who cared to listen that they wanted to see more action. And in response, they were really not seeing very much at all from government. And so I think that, once people realised that emissions that really should have been falling by at least 2 or 3 percent a year were actually going up by an estimated 2% a year. I think that message really came home. And so that was why I suspect Greta's actions caught on as quickly as they did. I think it's probably why in the US the Green New Deal has taken off to an extent that we haven't really seen before. I think it's extraordinary seeing so many Democratic candidates who have decided to back it. And even just the way in which climate change has featured in the Democratic debates so far and the Democratic campaigns has been really quite something. I mean, I've not seen these really extensive multi-page climate plans being issued at this stage of a presidential race or the primary race for many years, if at all. And so I think all of that does speak to a growing awareness. But I would also say that this is something we're seeing in the US, we're seeing it in Europe. It's a little bit harder to detect in other parts of the world, throughout much of Asia, and not to say that it doesn't exist, not to say that people aren't caring as much, but it's really been difficult to see quite the same level of action and activism on the streets.
What about China, particularly massive as it is?
Yeah, well, I mean, China is it's a conundrum in many ways. On the one hand, it's this extraordinary renewable energy giant, which has built up these extraordinary industries in solar panels and wind power and battery production. On the other hand, it is by far the world's largest carbon emitter. And thus far, we haven't seen any signs that it is going to be engaging in the sort or committing to the absolute reductions in emissions that are required. I mean, that's perfectly plausible and possible under the Paris Agreement, which basically says it's up to individual countries to determine how they will lower emissions. But it's interesting, though, I mean, that was a UN agreement, and next week's UN climate summit, the Secretary General, Mr. Guterres, has essentially told countries that they need to turn up with quite solid plans, which he wants them to be committing to end construction of new coal-fired power plants, for example, and he's pressing for more declarations of net zero emissions goals. Now, I mean, China is not quite there yet, and so it's going to be very interesting to see how it responds to this form of action, I think.
It's interesting you should say that more and more people are figuring out and deciding for themselves that they need to get involved, need to do something. Earlier, Weston Fribley mentioned the investment companies. There's a piece in The New Yorker this week by Bill McKibben, longtime activist in this area, saying that if one or two of the major banks, particularly Chase, were to advise companies differently from the way they are and get them to either disinvest or, in the case of the oil and gas companies themselves, to start behaving in a different way, it would have more impact than almost anything else you could possibly imagine. Do you see anything like that happening? Weston mentioned some banks. You said there's at least one bank in England that started out with all of that in mind. But to the extent that the economy is financialized in the first place, it seems to me it's a pretty important issue.
Internally, there are, I know, at many banks, very detailed and very serious discussions going on about this. And in fact, in public, the Bank of England Governor Mark Carney here warned several years ago that if there was the sort of shift that Bill McKibben is writing about, then it would result in stranded assets, essentially, that there would a whole lot of fossil fuels would have to be left underground. And he warned that this was going to be potentially a huge carbon bubble. It's fair to say that thus far, we haven't seen a whole lot of evidence that those warnings are being taken seriously. I know that they're being discussed internally. I know there are many people inside banks who are pondering this. I know the same sorts of discussions are being held inside fossil fuel companies, but I suspect that we may wait some time before we see the sorts of movement that that Mr. McKibben's talking about. You know, these things can happen quite quickly. You know, the sorts of changes that we've seen over the last 18 months weren't really predictable, I think, 2 years ago. You know, it's quite extraordinary to see this sort of change that's already occurred. But, you know, when it comes to a very large financial institution deciding to basically do away with quite a relatively small but nonetheless meaningful amount of revenue, then, you know, that's quite a move to take. Having said that, I think Bill McKibben's completely correct that if a very large bank were to decide to do this, we could easily see others follow very quickly. And, you know, that's in some ways quite a troubling prospect, really because if it happened very quickly, one could conceivably see many people being thrown out of work. We could see companies closing. This is precisely the sort of thing that Mr. Carney has been trying to warn about and saying that, you know, any action needs to happen gradually and gently. So, you know, maybe we will not see anything like this happen. But as I say, we're already seeing some unusual shifts in sentiment, at least in some countries, among some people, that we haven't seen before. And, you know, I think that it's hard to really try to map a direct link between the sorts of street activism we've seen and what impact that might have on, say, a big bank that lends a lot of money to an oil, gas, coal company. But the one other thing that has happened just in the last few months is, in some cases, in the last few weeks, in fact, is that, again, you know, we're seeing people like Mark Rylance, who's a very celebrated actor here, decide to quit the Royal Shakespeare Company because he no longer wanted to be associated with BP, which the company has had ties with. And similar actions have been taken by people connected to the British Museum. Just very recently, the New York Times said that it was going to be dropping its sponsorship of a very old conference, a very long-running conference called Oil and Money. You know, these sorts of things, I think, are part of this shift where we've seen individual institutions and quite preeminent figures decide to take action by themselves. That really, you know, it's hard to think of precedents for this. So, you know, what this amounts to thus far, you know, it's very, very difficult to say, but for the moment, I think it's absolutely fascinating to watch, and I would be surprised if it faded away completely anytime soon.
On the other hand, we're faced with deadlines, according to scientists, that are coming due very soon, tipping points, if you will, although there are those who say there's really no such thing. But the idea that it's really hard to get your mind around that the world economy is going to have to change in such a major way, if in fact we're really going to deal with this. And I'm interested, Weston Fridley, back to you with Amazon Employees for Climate Justice, how you feel about that. And when you hear that necessarily, in order to, you know, save the economy or not take action that's so drastic that it's almost intolerable, what about this idea of being gradual and gentle about it? Or is it a little too early for that?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of touched on this before, but I think, you know, I can only speak to my experience of, you know, how Amazon works and the way that we get things done internally. And that's by setting very bold goals. You know, we know kind of that you know, you don't set kind of like a meager goal and then try to make it. You set a really audacious goal. And if you fall a bit short, so be it. You know, we can always, you know, we can keep going past whatever date we set. But, you have to be able to set that direction. And it really, you know, when those kind of goals are set at the top of the company, things happen and those goals get achieved. And that's really, you know, from our experience working at this company, that's why we've taken these positions like zero emissions by 2030 for the whole company. Because, you know, first of all, we're convinced that that is actually possible. But also that's the way that you signal to everyone at Amazon that carbon reduction needs to be in the mix. You know, when I'm presenting, you know, a design for a new piece of software, for example, you know, nobody's asking me, oh, well, will this decrease our carbon emissions? That should be a question that's being asked, you know, across the company.
Do you raise it yourself? Is it something you can interject into the conversation?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible to kind of to bring that up, but you know, that can only go so far. Right? And you know, we've heard from you know, a lot of employees. One of the great things about doing this work is that, you know, employees across the company, you know, here in the U.S. and across the world will reach out and say, hey, I had this great idea about how I could reduce, how my team could reduce its emissions. And that's amazing to hear. And there's tons of really great ideas across the company. Those ideas need to be invested in by the leadership.
So, Polita Clark, that's the kind of thing you're seeing now on a broader basis, but you've not necessarily said in all parts of the world. What about the Middle East, so dependent as it is on fossil fuels?
Oh, yes. Well, that is a good question. I haven't actually seen anything from the Middle East, and that doesn't mean there hasn't been anything, but I really haven't seen very much evidence there. But just on that point that you were just discussing earlier, I think we're really just at the beginning of understanding what something like a net zero emission goal really means. You know, the UK, as I was saying, it's been one of the early adopters of a goal like this. And nonetheless, it's done very little to actually start implementing it, even though we've just recently seen a parliamentary report come out and talk about what sort of action is going to be required. And it's got some quite eye-popping statistics in it. For example, it's saying to meet the goals requirements but in relation to transport. That translates into taking something like 20,000 cars, conventional cars, off the road every week on average for the next 31 years. And just to put that in context, last year in this country, about 1,200 ultra-low emission cars were registered every week. So, you know, it's the same sort of thing happening when you look at the housing sector. At the moment, a lot of the, well, most homes here are heated with gas boilers, natural gas boilers. Now, they should be switching over to lower carbon forms of heating. And in fact, about 15,000 homes a week should be making that switch. And at the moment, under current policies, about 220 are. And it's the same for tree planting and a whole range of other areas where the sorts of action required is absolutely mammoth, and that's just in one country. So, you know, when you try to think about how this sort of action could be taken around the world, it really is quite daunting. One can easily just really find it difficult to kind of grapple with the sort of numbers and the size and scale of what's required. We're really talking about something that is more akin to wartime mobilization without an actual war. It's really, really something that very few generations have ever had to contemplate. So it's something that, this is why I think people are deciding that they need to speak out. They're becoming active, not just angry. And they're resenting almost definitely resenting, I think, the inaction that's been taken thus far. So whether that's going to be enough to actually achieve the sorts of step changes, these extraordinary sweeping changes that are going to be required, really does remain to be seen.
Let's just hear one more word from the young woman who has been so inspiring to so many people and who came across the Atlantic Ocean on a sailboat in order to address the Congress and to talk to the UN, speaking on The Daily Show.
I think people should do everything, but I think right now, if I were to choose one thing everyone would do, it would be to inform yourself and to try to understand the situation and try to push for a political movement that doesn't exist, because the politics needed to fix this doesn't exist today. So I think what we should do as individuals is to use the power of democracy that to make our voices heard and to make sure that the people in power actually cannot continue to ignore this.
Greta Thunberg, we've talked a lot about the challenges of what she is proposing, the nuances involved, the unintended consequences of possible action, and much appreciate that from Polita Clark with the Financial Times, Weston Fribley with Amazon Employees for Climate Justice. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And thanks also to Elsa Mengistu at Howard University as well. Today's podcast was produced by Andrea Brody. Our engineer is Chuck Prevetary. You can listen to our latest climate change update, talking about how you can change your carbon footprint one bite at a time by eating a plant-based diet. You can find that and all of our other episodes on your favorite podcasting app. Contact us on social media. Tweet us at tothepoint_KCRW. Leave a review. Contact me directly, warren.olney@kcrw.org. We want to know what you think and what you'd like to hear. Thanks for joining us this time.